All right, this is Wednesday, October 4th, 1989, and I'm Bill Jones interviewing Bob Engelstad. And Bob, let's just start off with you giving us a kind of an overview of where you came from and what your educational background is and what kind of work responsibilities you assumed during the course of your career.
Okay, it's kind of interesting because I kind of grew up within the shadows of this college. I've been resident of Morehead all my life.
Is that right?
I lived west of here, half a block for a while, for a few years when I was first born, and then two blocks north of it until I graduated from high school.
Well, this is home, all right.
And now I live south of the campus, a couple blocks. So I've lived around this campus all my life. I went to school at Concordia for 1 year. And then I went to NDSU for 5 years, and I graduated with two degrees, a Bachelor of Science in Architectural Engineering, which is structural, and then a Bachelor of Architecture.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then I went to work, I was working part-time with Foss and Company at that time. Then it became Foss Engelstad Foss, and I was there until January 1st, 1980. Then I kind of left the firm, and it was because we were bringing in some key people into our firm, and the only way we could really accomplish it, we've been working on it for 5 years, the only way we could make it happen was if one of us left.
I see. So I
decided to leave, and it was about 2 years earlier than I was thinking of going, but it worked out well. And I was into some developments. I took one project with me, and that was a language village for Concordia College.
Mm-hmm.
I've been working on that since it started, so
mm-hmm.
I took that with me. So that kept me busy, and then about 5 years ago, we started getting involved in handling recycling. And I had a warehouse complex out here in Morehead that we built in 72, and I'd had a hard time getting tenants, renters. And then we had several out there. We had the auto salvage business, and then we also had paper recycling. Well, the auto salvage closed down, and then the paper recycling kind of went belly up,
mm-hmm.
and about 83. And I ended up with a complex out there that was full of paper in the warehouses and baled paper outside, and I had to get rid of it. No way to get rid of it. So I hauled out 300 ton of paper to the landfill.
Oh.
And I got thinking that
I never
want to see another scrap paper around here again.
Uh-huh.
So then we started thinking about we want to get into the tire business. And then we decided we'd also maybe take some paper, but keep it paper clean.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I got started in part of it.
In the recycling business.
Right. But to back up, when I was with Foss Engelstad Foss, I was one of the principals in the firm.
Mm-hmm.
We designed some of the buildings. I was involved in some of the buildings here on the campus.
Yeah, well, let's talk a little bit about those kind of periods through which you went. Now, you started with Foss Engelstad in
1952.
All right. What was being built at that time? What was your...
Well, one of the first buildings that I got involved with on the campus here was Hagen Hall.
Mm-hmm.
It was back in, I think it was 57.
Okay, now were you the design architect?
I was a design architect on the project, right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I was involved in some of the others in the design, some of the dormitories and so
mm-hmm.
on.
Foss Engelstad had major responsibility for the growth of this campus.
Yeah, we did a lot of buildings on the campus,
yeah.
right.
So that happened in the 50s and through the 60s, too, I
right.
guess.
Right, yeah.
What are some of the other design?
Well, I was involved. I think every school in Morehead, for the public schools, I was involved with, either as an addition or a new building.
Mm-hmm. Like South Junior High.
South Junior High. I was involved in there. The additions to all the elementary schools.
Mm-hmm.
Designed the first vocational building, school.
Mm-hmm.
The high school.
Hmm.
And
so you've had your finger in the educational pie very definitely.
Yeah,
all
very,
that
very
period.
Strongly. I was very heavily involved in educational.
Yeah. Now that was an interesting time, wasn't it? Because education was a real growth industry at that time.
Yeah, you couldn't keep up. You couldn't build fast enough.
Yeah, yeah. It's amazing that society just all of a sudden decided that they were going to pour a lot of resources in that direction.
They really did, too.
Yeah, yeah. It's no longer quite the same.
No, I was involved in designing schools all over Iowa, Minnesota, North Dakota.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of an exciting era.
Oh,
yeah.
Yes, it's fantastic.
It really was, and education was changing so much, you know. We went through a period of time, like when we built the junior high schools, we had a lot of glass. That was a minimum amount of glass we could have in a classroom building at that time when we built those in 56.
These were state specifications?
State specifications in 56.
Mm-hmm.
1960, when we started adding on some of the elementary school additions, then we could get by with just a narrow slit of glass, like we did on the additions to Thomas Edison and so on, and Probst Field addition, or when we built Probst Field.
Yeah.
And then it was only a couple of years later, you didn't have to have any windows. So we went from just one extreme to the other.
Now, were these energy considerations, energy conservation considerations?
Well, to begin with, it was that you had to have so much natural light in a classroom.
I see.
Depending upon the square foot of the classroom, you had to have a certain area window to accomplish that. And so that's why all that glass.
I see.
And then, of course, at that time, you know, the energy was pretty cheap.
Yeah, that wasn't
the factor. You weren't designing for energy considerations, really.
No,
at that time,
oil was 6-9 cents a gallon or something like that.
That's right.
Who cared how much of it you had to burn?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, I live in a house designed by Mac Foss, and
was that the one over there on 13th Street?
Used to be flat roofed.
Sure,
yeah.
I know. Okay,
yeah,
that's only a couple of blocks from us.
And he was kidding me after I'd bought it. Well, he said, "You're heating the outside an awful lot, aren't you?" He says, "When I built that, it didn't matter."
Yeah,
yeah. Well, we put another roof on it now and filled the flat roof.
Yeah, you did a nice job on that.
It worked well, didn't it?
Yeah, because that. It was a nice house, you know, when you had the walls coming out. A flat roof house, you could do it, make it really look nice.
Mm-hmm.
But then to put a pitched roof on to keep the looks, it was difficult.
Tricky.
But you did a nice job.
Yeah, I'm very pleased with it. Well, those when did energy start to become a consideration? Was it the oil boycott 70?
Well, some of that it was before that even.
Is that right?
Oh yeah, we were looking at about the mid 60s. All of a sudden. For energy, like mm-hmm. high school, when I designed that, we were very energy conscious on that.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
But now we've even gone beyond what we're designing for that, even.
Yeah.
I was involved, the other one that I was involved with, I designed the shell of the building, the outside, and the council chambers in the Moore City Hall.
Oh, yeah.
And so when people said, boy, they sure didn't like when that City Hall went right down up Fifth Street there, we blocked off Fifth Street, and that was the start of the downtown area.
Yeah,
so I was kind of right in the center of that.
Yeah.
But it was an exciting building to design at that time.
Very attractive building. I've always liked that building. Yeah.
Well, it'll stay attractive for years too.
Yeah, yeah. Now, so that you had a major role as far as schools, and you did that. What are some of the other projects?
Well, let's see, NDSU Fieldhouse. I designed that, and that was a kind of a fun project to do.
Mm-hmm.
That was really the last project that I designed before I left the firm.
I see.
Heavily involved in designing it. Oh, that and the junior high school in Detroit Lakes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And your practice was really focused in this region then?
Well, we did a lot of work here, but we had, at the time when I left, we had up to 90 people working for us. We had 75 in Fargo, Moorhead, and we had 15 in Iowa. So we were a large firm for
mm-hmm.
our area,
mm-hmm.
way too large. But so we did cover, principally Minnesota, North and South Dakota, and Iowa.
I see.
We were working in some other states, a few projects in Nebraska, into Montana.
Mm-hmm. But now, who do you consider the major influences as far as your own design style and so on? You have some antecedents there that...
Well, it was kind of interesting. When I was going to school, I always had admired Frank Lloyd Wright. I wasn't a pupil of his in that sense, but I really liked what he was able to do.
Mm-hmm.
His earlier works I liked, but in his later years, they were pretty gaudy, I thought.
Yeah.
But I liked I'll tell you, when he was designing some of the structures back in the 30s, they were fantastic, and they still are. Mm-hmm. They look fantastic today.
Yeah, they've
you take a place like
well.
Falling Waters, that residence.
Yeah, Wingspread.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was unreal what he could do.
Yeah, yeah.
And I guess he was probably the main one in my life. Oh, I liked some of the European ones. They probably had a little influence on it, but I really can't tell any others.
Yeah. As far as materials are concerned, now you talked about glass as being absolutely necessary, and the more the better for a while, and then you moved away from that. Are there other trends as far as
we became heavily involved in a lot of precast work.
Mm-hmm.
When we did the Hagen Hall here, the double T slabs, the structural floor slabs, they were just coming into being.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we did this project here, that was a big project in precast.
Now, did you have to find someone who could do the precasting around here?
Well, it was done down at Wells, Minnesota, and part of it was done in South Dakota.
I see.
On this particular project. But they were vendors there, and we'd worked with them, and they had the design criteria there, what their slabs could hold and so on, and we utilized them.
Mm-hmm.
But then, of course, after that, I was the first one to use them as a wall panel. Mm-hmm. That was on Probstfield.
Oh, yeah.
And then the same supplier down there at Wells, we were doing an awful lot of work here. We were doing a high school with them, and those are some 100-foot, 110-foot single tees in that overspanning the gym.
Mm.
And we had some 80-foot double tees on the vocational school, which was being built at the same time. And so I kept kidding them that, you know, someday I want to take these 14-inch deep double tees, which are a floor slab, and I'd like to just pin those on a footing or hook them to a footing and pin them together and make a church out of it. Yeah, that would really be exciting to do that. And then a few years went by, and then one day I said to him, I said, well, let's go do that church now. And then he said, I don't know how we'll do it. So he went to a conference down in Florida about that same time and was visiting with some other people, and I told him, now, why don't you take these double T stems? You know, you're familiar with a double T.
Yeah.
Okay. They got two stems on them.
Yeah.
So why don't you, put these together, let's put a hinge up here, a real hinge. You take two sleeves and put them on one of these double T's, and we'll put a single one on the other one, so when they come together, they'll interlock there, and we'll just put a pin in there and fasten it.
Lock them.
Mm-hmm. So they went back and designed that, and that's how we built Christ the King in Moorhead.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
We call that our high sidewall church on a low sidewall budget.
Yeah. I imagine that was a fairly economical structure.
Yeah, very economical. We built that structure, and that was put up in 62, that part. And we spent $125,000 for that, including the pews and carpet.
Fantastic. That's a lot of square feet, actually.
Yeah, there are. It's 100 feet long and 50 feet wide.
Yeah. Yeah.
But we got that high sidewall effect on low sidewall budget.
Well, it's an attractive structure, and
it
works
gonna
very
hold
well.
Up.
Yeah.
But that was the first one in the country that had been done like that, because when they brought those double T's, they were 60 feet long. They brought them in on this trailer. And, of course, they're long enough, all they have is a dolly on the back end of these things.
Mm-hmm.
And when the guy walked in there to untie these things, those things went up and down like a floppy old 2x4.
Is that right?
Well, they were in the weakest position like that, but when you put them up like that, all of a sudden they became strongest position.
Sure, yeah. Well,
so it was really kind of fun to do.
Well, I can see where it was very satisfying, as a matter of fact.
But the precast was really did a lot, had a lot of effect on our projects. We use a lot of it. Like the City Hall, you know, that's a precast job. That's a load-bearing wall. They're very thick, those panels.
Yeah.
But we shaped them so that we did.
Yeah.
And concrete, the only limitation is your imagination, really, with that.
Mm-hmm. You can sculpt them.
Yeah, just about any way you want to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Any other materials that that became that you moved into during the course of your career?
We had one, and I wish they hadn't gone bankrupt, this company, but it was a plastic on the fuel house at NDSU. We got metal paneling there now. But at one time, those were 10-foot wide panels. They were 40 feet high, and we had three panels high. So it was made in three panels. But what I had accomplished, and then if you took 30 feet wide, so it was three bays, in those nine panels, I had a relief in fiberglass, ins and outs. And so, I mean, the total depth of the wall was up to close to 18 inches in some mm-hmm. places where it might have stuck out, and then it went back in it, but yet thick enough so we had good insulation in the wall.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a relief that was kind of repeated every 30 feet on there, and it was tremendous design. And we had gone all the way through to the point where we were getting shop drawings for this material to go on, and it would have been just one fantastic wall, because the sun playing on these ins and outs would have been just very dramatic. Well, during the course of the shop drawings, when we were approving the shop drawings, they went belly up.
Oh.
So all of a sudden, there we were. We didn't have a siding on there, and so we had to go to something. And so we went to this particular metal siding that had a little bit of shadow on it, but mm-hmm. nothing compared to what we had.
That's frustrating.
Yeah, it is. But that would have been a really an exciting product, because mm-hmm. It would have been nice on there.
Now, you've obviously seen Moorhead and Fargo grow an awful lot in your years here. I'd be interested in your reaction to the nature of the growth, particularly residential housing. You didn't do a lot of residential housing,
No,
did
we,
you?
We did.
Yeah. When we first came here in 1972, we were very frustrated in trying to find a house. Everything was ranch style, mm-hmm. or what do they call it? Rambler, I guess.
Yeah.
Now, what dictated that architectural style anyway? Was this just a matter of convenience?
I think it was
economy?
Convenience. Yeah? People, all of a sudden, you know, they had they could put it on one floor, and I think it was cheaper.
Yeah.
And say, go in a two-story house.
Yeah. So you go out south of the university here now, and
yeah.
then just
ranch. Well, when I grew up, we used to play touch football on the campus here all the time.
Sure.
A bunch of us little kids, and lived right north of here when I was started kindergarten on 4th Avenue, 1310 4th Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
A block away was the edge of town.
Yeah.
And that was the edge of town for years, 14th Street. There was nothing beyond 14th Street. South of 4th Avenue.
Yeah.
There were a few houses on 4th Avenue on the south side, but beyond that it was field. The carnival used to be up there where 5th Avenue would be, out there in the field all the time. And that went on for years, you know. There's nothing. And then a few houses south of the campus here on 11th Street.
Yeah.
Just down to the first avenue south of the block south of here. And that was the edge of town.
Mm-hmm.
And I can remember when they opened up the wheat field in there in the 50s, or maybe it was the late 40s. I can't remember. But anyway, when they built a few houses right south of the campus here, I thought they're crazy. And then in 52, we bought a lot out where we live now. And this was on the 1506. It'd be right where 15th Avenue would be on 12th Street.
Yeah.
And I took my wife out there. They were just developing this. And there wasn't a house south of 12th Avenue or east of 8th Street in Moorhead when I bought the lot. I took her out there and showed her this beautiful lot I bought. I wasn't in college yet. And it was at night, and she cried. She could hear the Mexicans singing over at Myers Farm on 14th Street. And she thought, my stars, if we can live out in the country, why don't we move way out?
Yeah.
Now the center of town is south of us.
Yeah.
So it was unreal what happened in the 50s here as far as residential building. You couldn't build them fast enough.
Yeah. And Moorhead was getting the bulk of the growth, I guess.
Yeah,
at that time.
Well, it was such a tax difference here, and we were a bedroom community for Fargo.
Mm-hmm.
There were many people who were living in Moorhead that were working in Fargo.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Is there anything else as far as, I want to get to your recycling business too before we're through, but while we're still on architecture now, I guess I would be interested in your own kind of sense of what you found most satisfying in what you were doing during
the years. It was interesting. When I went to school, the two subjects I shied away from were speech and English. I hated that. Communication.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I thought that 95% of my time I'm going to sit behind a drawing board, 5% I'm going to communicate with somebody. And that flip-flopped in a period of a few years, and all of a sudden I was communicating 95% of the time and 5% drawing.
Mm-hmm.
And if I was going to go back and do it all over again, I'd really want to take a lot of that.
Mm-hmm.
That's so important to communicate.
Mm-hmm.
I was communicating through drawings, but you also have to use voice.
Got to relate to clients.
You really do, and I learned that the hard way.
Mm-hmm.
And I did enjoy meeting with clients. And I got involved a lot in programming a project and also designing it. Mm-hmm. And it was fun to take the comments of people, how they felt they wanted to relate to a space and put it into physical being.
Mm-hmm.
That was exciting.
Mm-hmm. What what were some of your frustrations?
I think the biggest frustrations we had were school boards and county commissions. We found and that was one of the reasons why I didn't mind leaving, because it was getting so frustrating. You were getting people who served on some of these boards for the wrong reasons.
Mm.
They were there to grind an axe. They weren't there to probably promote the best educational system for their area or do something else. They were there, they're going to get that one item through regardless.
Mm-hmm.
It was very frustrating.
Mm-hmm.
And I think another thing, too, there were so many restrictions on things, so many regulations you had to meet, and they kept getting worse every year. And all of a sudden, it was tough to design
mm-hmm.
a good building.
Mm-hmm. Now, these regulations were, what, OSHA, EPA?
Yeah, OSHA and EPA, and then you had a lot of those kind of regulations, fire and so on. All of a sudden, you couldn't do things that
the
you
codes,
could do before.
The codes became
codes
more and more
really,
restrictive.
Right. Mm-hmm. So designing was becoming tough.
Mm-hmm. Now, would you say the city of Moorhead was consistent with other communities in that respect as far as
code
changes?
Oh, yeah, they were about the same.
Right. It was kind of a universal
right.
sort of
mm-hmm.
establishment of code.
Well, we found, not necessarily here with the school board here, we always felt we had a pretty good school board to work with here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But when we got out in some of the smaller communities, it's you would shudder at what you'd run into.
Yeah. Yeah.
At that time, you know, the state was thinking, they were talking anyway, maybe they should control all the schools. And boy, I think they should have at that time,
yeah.
a lot of them, because of the school board members that were coming on.
Protect them from some pretty bad
yeah.
mistakes.
Oh, there are some districts here that really suffered because of school board members.
Mm-hmm.
It's too bad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's...
But I think the most exciting project I've had to work on, I think they've all been fun. They've all been a challenge, but the... Even when you've done a lot of schools, everyone's is a challenge, because we weren't just designing a school. We were designing, taking people's ideas and trying to put them to work.
Mm-hmm.
I had probably the most interesting case in Iowa when we were designing a high school down there, and I was meeting with the home economics department head. There were three high schools being built at the same time. And I had been meeting with her for a long time in the morning, and I had a beautiful layout. It was just what they had wanted. And I kept telling her that we were going to have to, we're over budget, so we're going to have to make some cuts. And I just tore the plan apart, telling her we're going to have to take this out, we're going to have to take that out. And she was very formal. She was always calling me Mr. Engelstad. So we broke for lunch, and I came back finally, and I said, well, all these things we talked about, we've got to make all these cuts. And I really ruined that home economics department. And I said, we're going to have to make everyone, unless you quit calling me Mr. Engelstad. She said, all right, Mr. Engelstad. And then she quit, and then she said, all right, Bob. But, well, what it did, see, I wanted her ideas. I wanted her to tell me, yes, this works, it doesn't work.
Yeah.
And she couldn't do that.
You were the authority figure.
Right. But the minute she said Bob, then all of a sudden she came down and she was able to express herself. We didn't make one single change in the whole economics department. But I wanted to find out, is this what you really want here?
Really got through to her.
Yeah. Well, it was kind of fun. But I think the most exciting project I've worked on is the Language Village.
Is that right?
Yeah.
How did you get involved with that?
Well, we got involved during the, when they were just going to start designing, well, they were buying the land.
Oh, yeah.
But they're going to start a Norwegian village. And I had done the stadium over at Concordia. I designed that.
Mm-hmm.
And so then they hired us to work on the Language Village, and I was assigned the project, and it just grew. It was exciting.
Yeah.
No guidelines.
Well, did you research pretty to make the indigenous?
Well, what we did on a Norwegian village, they weren't going to pay for any trips. They had paid for one trip with somebody, and they weren't going to pay for any more. So I said, well, I'll take a vacation over there, and I'll make a trip out of it. Mm-hmm. We won't charge you for it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we need to go see it, what we want to do, instead of looking at books.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted to kind of capture what was distinctly Norwegian.
Sure.
So we went over there, and we had a well-planned trip where we were going to see things, certain people were going to meet us. And what I found there, that when you were over there, that you couldn't take any contemporary architecture because it looked just like ours.
Sure.
But what I did notice was the country architecture.
Mm-hmm.
That was distinctly Norwegian. There's no question about it. And the architects over there said, well, don't picture us as country architecture. But that was distinctively Norwegian. So what I did, I took those designs into our method of construction to do it.
You didn't put any grass on the roof, sod roof.
We were going to have one with sod on it, but it doesn't work too well.
Not in
no. Well, we captured the old country architecture there.
Yeah. Oh, I think it was very successful.
Yeah, and then, of course, the German, that was we could capture something there very distinctively.
Mm-hmm.
French has been a little tougher.
Mm-hmm. You were involved with all of
them. Oh, yeah,
I'm
still involved. I'm still designing involved. The main French building right now.
Is that right?
We have two provinces built there now. One captures Bretagne, the other one captures Provence.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But they were a little tough. But the main building is a little easier.
Yeah.
That'll be the dining and activity building and so on.
Mm-hmm. That's kind of a unique opportunity in a way, wasn't it?
It really was. Yeah.
Not many architects would have an opportunity like that.
It's very unique, and it's exciting because no guidelines, as I mentioned.
Mm-hmm. So you could be free to really exercise your imagination.
And we had some good people to work with through the whole thing.
Well, that's great. Well, let's move on now. You must have also, you said you had this building out in the industrial park. You must have been doing a little real estate speculation.
Well, we got involved in my wife and I in buying a shopping center in St. Petersburg. It was all by accident, and it worked out well. We kept that for 10 years, but it was a nice experience.
Sure.
And we were involved. We have other real estate in Moorhead, and we had some in Fargo.
And, and one piece of that real estate was this plant out there in the industrial
one
park.
One of them was the plant, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I was involved with West Acres.
Were you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That was your firm, wasn't it?
Yes, our firm was involved in it, and some of us were stockholders in that at the same time.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, that's proven to be remarkably successful, kind of a pioneering effort, actually, as far as...
Well, it was. It was kind of gutsy when you thought about going out there on 13th Avenue. There's nothing there except a gravel road coming out from Fargo.
Yeah, what a change.
Yeah, it really did. It shaped the western part of Fargo.
Oh, yeah.
See, we were originally going to go downtown on Main Avenue,
mm-hmm.
where the professional building is there and Norwest Bank is.
Mm-hmm.
But then we got our solution got turned down by the city. So,
I see.
And it was the best thing in the world.
Well, I I've heard Bill Schlossman say that, that, boy, they were saved from making a terrible mistake.
Oh, it would have been.
Well, so you had this building out here, and you said you had, it was full of paper, and you didn't know what to do with it, and you had to dump it, which must have been something.
Well, the county wasn't too happy about it, but the, you know, I had the fire department on my neck,
sure.
And I had the health department, and it was a real mess.
Yeah.
And I thought the guy was cleaning it out, but he was filling it up because he couldn't get rid of the paper.
Yeah.
So we haul it out, and I tried marketing it all over, or just to get rid of it.
Sure.
Couldn't do it, so we had to haul it out to landfill.
Hmm.
That was expensive.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the question was, what do you do with two buildings out here? We had 4 acres of land plus these two big buildings. Because I've been trying to rent them.
Mm-hmm.
And to bring a business into more, it was very difficult.
Yeah.
It was easier for them to go across the river.
Yeah, taxes and work.
But I couldn't move the property over the, across the river, so.
Yeah.
What do you do with two buildings? And at that time, we thought of collecting tires. Because there was a need for that, because you couldn't landfill them anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So we thought, well, we'll just collect them. And then so we checked with the state to get a permit. Well, none was required, but they were working on it. So what we did, we started setting up guidelines. If we were going to store tires, then we would set it up on their guidelines that
mm-hmm.
they were going to put into effect.
Mm-hmm.
So we worked on that for a long time, and then a year ago last May, it became law that you had to have a permit to haul tires, store tires, or process tires.
Mm.
And that came on May 20th. May 21st was the date that they became law. And we had 90 days, up to 180 days, to get a permit application in. We had a permit application in 9 days, and it was over an inch thick. It took 7 months for the state to process that permit. We were the first one in the state to be permitted as a processing facility.
Mm-hmm.
We got that in December.
Mm-hmm.
We had been collecting tires for a couple of years just to start establishing a stream.
Sure.
And then we actively started collecting tires after that. And now we're working on trying to get a permit to store a finished product. You wouldn't think it'd be tough to get a permit to store a finished product, but it's really been tough.
What is the product?
Well, let me show you. I got a few samples here. I guess the best way to...
We can
take a tire down to these different sizes here. And let me just... We got a market for that one-inch one. That could be added to lignite coal.
Okay, now these are simply chewing up a tire into one-inch size shreds.
Right. What we do, mm-hmm. we have a shredder that takes it down. And I was going to bring a piece that's about this long with steel hanging out of it. You wouldn't believe all the steel in these tires.
Oh, yeah.
The steel in this particular sample is thicker than my thumb.
That makes
all the cables in there.
That makes life interesting for you.
So we take a tire... And we'll run it through a shredder, slow-speed shredder, and that takes it down to various size
mm-hmm.
shreds.
Mm-hmm.
And we run it through another piece of equipment, a hammer mill, that blows it apart. And this is our one-inch chip.
Yep.
Okay. Here's three-quarter and one-half inch. We have a market for that in Colorado. They take that chip down to a smaller size. Now, here's a quarter-inch chip. This is used in asphalt overlay.
Now, you say you do have market for the half and the three-quarters, is that right?
Yeah, that's in Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
We're getting some requests for this material where they want a lot of that material. They're going to use that in asphalt overlay.
What asphalt overlay? What
they'll
does
mix that,
mean?
With asphalt, to like that strip on the I-94 going down to St. John's University.
Yeah.
There's a test strip in there.
Oh, yeah.
There's rubber in there.
Oh, yeah.
But that has quarter-inch in. Now, this is a finer material. That we have several counties that want that, and they want a lot of material.
Mm-hmm.
Here's some 20 and 30 mesh material.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This material is used in crack sealant for patching cracks
in the pavement.
In the streets.
In the streets, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Morehead and Fargo use that material right now. They buy it in a pre-mixed block.
Mm-hmm.
But that kind of material has to go into that block to make it.
Hmm.
And it lasts much longer than the regular. And then, of course, you have some fabric in a tire, which has a market. And that's the fabric in a tire.
Yeah. Is that nylon?
That's a nylon.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And can be reprocessed.
What do they use that for?
Well, a good example, the easiest one is the banding tape that you might find with a filament in it.
Oh, yeah.
It could be made out of this.
Uh-huh.
Then the other one is the steel. We pull the steel out, so it's clean.
And that's just scrap?
No, that's high-grade steel.
Oh, is that right?
That's got a good value on it, yeah. So there isn't anything in the tire that we don't use.
Uh-huh.
The only thing that we haven't found a market for is the dust.
Mm-hmm.
Well, basically, everything else is. In fact, some tires have a gel inside where they put a gel in there to make the tire solid, like industrial tires, so that they don't get punctures.
Oh.
And a lot of
machinery. Oh, yeah. Instead of air, in other words. They're not,
a gel
they're
not
in pneumatic.
It. Well,
yeah.
What do you do with the gel? There's even a market for the gel.
Is there really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that can be reused again.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, are you in full production?
No, we're putting a lot of equipment in right now. We're really waiting to get a permit because right now we cannot stockpile any of these chips.
I see.
Until we get a permit.
Yeah.
You wouldn't think it'd be so difficult to get a permit, but we've had a lot of frustrations in even getting where we are right now.
Now, is this local regulation or state?
Well,
regulation?
It's state and city and county.
I see.
We have to have permits from both.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But locally, it's been a tough job to get this project through.
Mm-hmm. What I've kind of followed it in the newspapers a little bit, but I haven't been able to understand it.
Well, they've had a committee studying solid waste for going on almost 10 years now.
Mm-hmm.
On what to do with it. And I don't think they like having somebody come in and solve part of the problem.
Hmm.
Because it's interesting. Well, it's not interesting. It's frustrating that since we were permitted in December, we have not had one city council person or one county commissioner call or come out to see what we're doing. And, you know, there's just no interest. In fact, we've had some people who have been involved in some of the department meetings say that, you know, it's almost like they wish we weren't here.
Hmm.
That if they don't pay any attention, maybe we'll die. Well, and we've also been told that we're not economic development, but we're going to have $2.5 million in our processing facility. And we got 12 people on the payroll today that weren't there a year ago. But to me, that's economic development. And we haven't asked any public entity for money.
Yeah.
It's all private.
Mm-hmm.
But the interesting thing is that when we get our facility fully operational, there won't be another one like it in the country.
Is that right?
There's nobody right now in this country that can do what we can do with the chips in two machines.
Hmm.
Now, they had an operation at Babbitt. The state funded that thing. And they were going to do the same thing we are. They went through 13 machines to do that.
Hmm.
They're bankrupt today. And the state poured the money in it.
Well, now, did you design the machine?
No. We just happened to walk into a machine that had not been designed for this project. This kind of project, but it had been designed to process sugar bagasse from sugar cane.
Hmm.
And very tough fiber to process. This thing is like a tank. It's the only one in the country. We're getting two more.
Where are they manufactured?
They were made in Switzerland,
hmm.
But they aren't being made anymore.
Hmm.
The machine we have right now was built in 1966. We retrofitted it. It had been in a paper mill here in the United States. Processing sugar bagasse for paper,
mm-hmm.
And they went when the fuel prices went up. They closed their plant.
Yeah,
so we happened to luck into the guy who had designed the machine. He had a agreement with a paper company that if they ever quit, that he'd get the machine back. And we happened to luck into this guy a little over a year ago,
mm-hmm.
who designed it and had it built. He had his own plant in Switzerland. And then we're getting two more machines similar to it. They're coming out of Puerto Rico.
Is that right?
Yeah.
In other words, they're used machines, too.
One is used. They were built in 61. The sugar mill bought two of them, thinking they need both of them. But the one is all they use. The other one's still in the crate. We hope it's still there. It's supposed to, after Hugo.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think it's blown away, Oliver.
Oh, I'll tell you that thing. Well, the piece of machinery we have right now weighed over 44,000 pounds.
Hmm, quite a bear to ship.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Well, it's exciting to take a waste like a tire, and in 2 minutes we can take it down to this. And that's about the timetable it'll be before when it goes through and it's in a bin.
Mm-hmm.
But our facility, when we get fully operational, we'll be able to process 3 million tires a year.
And there is that kind of stream from this?
Well, you can figure there's
a wide circle you have
to
draw.
Well, we got to go a wide area.
Mm-hmm.
No, you can figure that for every person, one tire is generated.
Annually?
Annually.
Okay.
So North Dakota would generate 600,000, Minnesota 4 million.
Yeah.
Now, we expect to get into Wisconsin to process, to shred tires there and bring them back here to process.
Mm-hmm.
We might even be going into Colorado to get shredded rubber, to get tires and shred it and bring it back.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's so expensive to set up a processing facility that, you know, we can do it here and then ship the material back out again. But it's expensive. It's to set the whole thing up.
Oh, I can imagine.
But it does take care of a tire.
And that is a difficult thing to dispose of.
Yeah, they really are. You can't bury them. Of course, that's Minnesota and North Dakota. You can't landfill them. Now, Minnesota, you can't even stockpile them.
Mm-hmm. And you certainly can't burn them anymore.
No, not as a whole tire, no.
Yeah.
But you can mix it with lignite. It's
okay.
Excellent.
That's what your 1-inch...
We'll use a 1-inch and above up to 2 inches. For mixing with lignite coal.
Mm-hmm.
We see that as a very short-term use of the chips for that because we're getting so many requests for the finer material that we don't see having enough material to want to burn it.
Hmm.
Yeah, but it does clean up the sulfuric emissions off the lignite coal.
It does.
Well, what you do, you put in, add 10% by BTU rubber to coal.
Okay.
Now, there is about 7,800 BTUs in a pound of lignite. It's very wet.
Yeah.
There's 16,200 BTUs in a pound of rubber.
So
basically what you're doing, you're getting the intense heat that's helping to dry up the lignite coal, but you're also reducing the sulfur at the same time.
Yeah.
So it's helping to clean up the atmospheric conditions.
Yeah. Well, that's really a remarkable... seems to me a remarkable solution to what is a difficult disposal problem.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah.
We see right now, of course, the county and the state, well, where are your markets? You really should have the markets before you get a permit to store any chips.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you can't develop markets until you have a material to give them.
Yeah.
So it's been really frustrating on that level.
Yeah.
But it's... It's coming.
It's coming. Now you have to. You're still waiting permits both from the county.
Yeah, the and county the and the state
and the
go
state.
Together.
They'll
happen the same day.
I see.
Mm-hmm. One is dependent upon the other.
How about the city? Are the
city is part of the county one. Now I we see. Have to get the county requirements. We have to go through the make sure that we meet all the city codes.
I see.
Like with the fire marshal and the building inspector.
Mm-hmm.
Which we've done. We've got that all accomplished.
And,
well, you wouldn't believe it would take so long. They've been working on our permit to store the chips since February.
Is that right?
We think we'll have the 12th of October, we will be through the 30-day comment period.
Mm-hmm.
And then they can issue the... Then they can take the permit to get approval from the MPCA board and then also from the county board.
I see.
Then we'll be permitted.
Oh, boy. Well, I can see with a substantial investment like that, you'd like to start production. And
well, yeah, we want to actively be producing. Right now, we're doing a lot of construction work. we're trying to create an image out there. And you have to go by to see what we're trying to create. We just finished our landscaping. Now we've got room for landscaping on Boulevard.
Mm-hmm.
Which had a Sierra Boulevard. It's the nicest spot in any... I think if you went through the whole industrial park, there isn't any place that even comes close to what we're doing. Or even the business sector.
Mm-hmm.
That we've really taken pains, and we're trying to create an image that we may be handling a waste, but we don't have to look like a treasure.
Sure, sure.
And being paper clean is very important to us. When we were... Before the Board of Adjustment last May to get our site approved in Fargo for handling garbage, we were going into the industrial park on a piece of city land. Well, we got turned down by the Board of Adjustment. City wanted us to buy that land because there were people in the industrial park there who didn't want to be next to a dump yard. And I made the comment at that time, too, we don't either. Because if there's any paper blowing around, we're going to get blamed for it.
Sure.
See, everything we do is done inside.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
we're going to be highly landscaped, so we're going to be aesthetically pleasing to drive by.
Now, as far as capital formation is concerned, is it mostly local capital? Or?
No, it's... I can't really say that. No, there's very little local monies in here as far as investors. I have, we have about 18 people involved at the most.
Mm-hmm.
I would say there might be five Fargo-Moorhead people.
I see.
With myself.
Yeah.
And we have some from around the Detroit Lakes, Park Rapids area. I mean, Frazee area, Pelican Rapids.
Mm-hmm.
See, I have a group of turkey growers involved in it.
Oh, really?
Well, they have a problem with turkey litter. And so what we're doing, we want the turkey litter. So they were, some of them were kind of excited to get involved on a small basis with us on this project because they have a chance to get rid of their litter, which we'll add into our compost program.
So now, the compost program, does that occur on the same site?
It'll be all done in Fargo.
That'll be done in Fargo.
Yeah, we're going to process waste in Fargo, the garbage.
Okay. Now, this is... No, we're off of tires now.
We're off of tires. That's part of it, yeah.
All right. Now, let's
well,
go.
Well, no, let's see. One other thing we've done in Moorhead, we've opened up a redemption center.
Okay.
Where people can bring in aluminum, which other places are taking aluminum, but they can bring in glass, they can bring in tin cans, and four types of plastic right now.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, we'll expand this where they can bring in paper and clothing and all kinds of metals.
Mm-hmm.
But for right now, we're just starting with this part.
I see.
And we'll always have the redemption center because we want to be able to handle every facet of recycling. For there are people who are always going to want to pull things apart and take them out someplace and get rid of them.
Mm-hmm.
So we always want to have that door open. We like to get it clean.
Yeah.
And we're willing to pay for that kind of material.
Because
the price is better for us if it's clean than if we have to separate it out of the garbage.
Yeah, yeah. Now, we just we lived in Lexington, Massachusetts for about 6 weeks this summer. They have a process of picking up glass, cans, and paper as a separate pickup.
Right.
And I noticed in the Lexington paper that it was a money-making project, partly because the city was paying them because for the disposal costs, you know, if they had to pick them up as garbage and dispose of it, obviously that would add to their costs of disposal. And but also, obviously, there's income in selling the stuff. And they, the paper was saying it's a real success.
Yeah. Paper is, you collect the paper, that's an up and down thing.
Mm-hmm.
One day the market is in strong demand, the next day it's a glut.
Hmm.
So the big problem is what to do with it. And we've created, in our Fargo project, we put together some elements that are extremely crucial to a project. First of all, you need garbage, and you need markets for what you can recycle. But last of all, and the most important is, what do you do with the leftovers? If you don't have any place to get rid of the leftovers, you don't have a project. Now, one of the first things that we put into place, we did create a market, a strong market for our burnables. In other words, when we pull all the paper out, North Dakota Board of Higher Education approved our proposal to NDSU to burn our burnables in lieu of coal when we start making it. So that's coming up. But the most important one that we put together was with the City of Fargo. We have a 20-year agreement with the City of Fargo to bury our residual. And we can bring the garbage from anywhere and process it, but we have to process it.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll take our residual.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the most important element right there.
Yeah, so you can be absolutely, everything is gone. Everything is disposed of.
We can't have anything left over.
Yeah.
And that we have, and what we're doing right now, we're finishing up our permit application for the state of North Dakota. It should go in next week because we do want to get started on that facility right away.
Mm-hmm. So you're building a facility.
We'll build a facility in Fargo. We were hoping that we could still get in the ground with some footings yet this fall. We may yet.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, we may wait till spring.
And the composting now, what are you composting?
Well, we're going to compost the wet fragments.
I see.
We'll pull out the wet fragments, and we run it through a very high-speed shredder, and then we'll mix it with the turkey litter, and then we put it in enclosed vessels like a silo, like a harvest store silo.
Yeah.
And we'll keep it there, and we'll control the temperature and the moisture and until it decomposes.
Mm-hmm.
Then we'll move it to another vessel. There we'll let the temperature go way up so we kill the pathogens. Then we move it to a curing area where all we're going to do is just keep turning it until such time as it's not going to heat up.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
then after that, then we've got a product that we'll run through a final screen, pull out any slivers of plastic or something in it. And basically when we get done, it'll be a soil additive. We're not going to sell it as a fertilizer, but just a soil additive.
Soil additive.
That you could buy in a, like the Kmart's or something like
yeah.
that.
Mm-hmm.
But it has to be non-abrasive, it has to be biologically safe, and no odor.
Mm-hmm. Now, it won't, in other words, it won't analyze into X percent nitrogen.
No, there will be. We won't sell it as a fertilizer because you have to have those percentages have to be exact.
Or, yeah, yeah.
And we won't call it out on a bag, but it's just strictly a soil additive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But we expect to have a regional processing facility built in Fargo that will eventually, say in a 10-year period, we hope to cover 75-mile radius.
Mm-hmm.
We're gearing the plant so that we can keep expanding it so we can handle anywhere from 200 to 250,000 ton a year.
Mm.
Now, to give you an idea, Clay County buries 35,000 a year. Fargo, Cass County, is 100,000.
Yeah. So you've got to throw your net pretty wide in order to
come up with that. Well, yeah, we are right now handling Becker County waste. We're mm-hmm. transporting Becker County waste to the Fargo landfill,
mm-hmm.
which we have permission to do so until such time as we get operational.
Mm-hmm. Has the permit process been as difficult on the North Dakota side?
No.
Yeah.
No, it won't be anything like Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
The reason we went over to Fargo is that we'd never get a permit here.
Is that right?
The resistance would be too great.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, that's obviously... the thing that's amazing to me, Bob, is that here you are in a rural area. Let's face it, this is... North Dakota's most rural state in the Union, except Mississippi, somebody told me once. And obviously western Minnesota is rural. You don't have a heavy population concentration. And here you are establishing a center which seems to me would be a model for almost any place. But wouldn't life be easier? I'm not trying to talk you. No, I worry. You're already here. But wouldn't it have been easier to try to do this in a metropolitan area where the supplies were adequate and where they were running out of space for landfill and so on?
We are working in two other communities right
now.
Oh,
are you?
Yeah. And it's going to be interesting to see which one goes first.
Yeah.
But there are two big ones, big communities.
Yeah.
But this is an interesting area because in a big community, you're just handling a small area of high population.
Yeah.
What do you do in the rural area like here where North Dakota is talking about closing most of the landfills? Where do these little teeny communities take their waste?
Yeah.
What we're trying to promote is a total solid waste recycling facility where if you generate a waste, we will take it.
Yeah.
One way or the other.
Yeah.
And if it's an industrial waste, you don't have to bring it to us in because you have a choice. You can have it shipped to Chicago or wherever they might process that waste, like a paint sludge. That's a good example.
Sure.
The small generators, the body shops, what do they do with it? Goes in dumpsters, goes out to landfill. That's bad. That's a no-no.
Yeah.
Now, the big generators, like when Steiger was here, that was a barrels of material that...
Oh, yeah.
At one time, they got approval to bury that in part of a landfill. Then... After they buried it, the North Dakota Department of Health came back and said, no, you can't do that. So they had to dig it up and ship it to Louisiana or someplace down there.
Mm.
That was very expensive.
Yeah.
So what do those generators of industrial waste do? What we're saying is we'll be a center where you can bring it to us. You can get by it. If you can move it cheaper someplace, that's fine. But at least we'll be there to take care of the waste that somebody can't get rid of.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Old cars. Where do they go now? Geller's doesn't take them all. They don't want all those old junkers. They got to go someplace. So yeah. We're willing to take them. We'll stockpile them till we have enough cars. We'll bring in a crusher, move them out.
Mm-hmm.
But we want to be a total recycling center for any waste that's generated.
And we
feel that we eventually go out beyond 100 miles taking garbage.
Mm-hmm.
There are going to be communities who will haul their waste in for 100 miles to have it processed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And essentially you're providing the service to them. They provide the raw material for you,
That's right.
for your industry.
Right.
Yeah, and so it's kind of a trade-off there.
You bet.
Yeah, yeah.
Because some of these small communities with these stipulations are putting on landfills, there's no way they can build a landfill.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They're expensive.
Mm-hmm.
They're getting more expensive because of the monitoring system you have to put in, the clay liner that they want.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's fascinating.
And then it's a shame to see all that material going to waste.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're such a throwaway society that we think that it's going to be there forever. You know,
yeah.
You look at generations from now, what are they going to do for some of these raw materials that we're eating up like crazy?
Yeah, no, I think it's fascinating and highly socially responsible.
It's been probably politically, it's been the most frustrating project that I could have ever wanted to work on.
Mm-hmm.
But it's been so exciting
with
what you can do. And as an architect, a lot of people say, boy, that's quite a change from being an architect. But it really isn't. There's a lot of planning that goes into it. I do a lot of drawing, a lot of designing.
Sure.
We're designing our own layouts.
Mm-hmm.
It's like our tire project. There's no company we could go to and say, what do we need?
Yeah.
It's all trial and error.
Mm-hmm.
And we're doing a lot of changing, even on a type of conveyor.
Sure.
We had a conveyor that came off our hammer mill that was 3 feet wide and flat. So when the material came off the hammer mill, it spread evenly, steel, fabric, rubber. And then we narrowed it down we went through a little chute and put it on another conveyor that was kind of shaped like this,
mm-hmm.
but narrower. And that went up to an impact screen that separated out all the sizes. Well, and we had a magnetic pulley on the head up there, so when it went up there, we pulled the steel off.
Sure.
Well, as the material went up there, the steel and the fabric tumbled together and made big clumps. So when it attached itself to the magnetic field, it trapped a lot of fine rubber up there. And so we had a lot of waste that was tipped off.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we can't have that because there's too much good material in there.
Sure.
And we weren't separating the steel off. So we had to pull that conveyor off. We made a new one where now it's wide and flat. And then we also have a magnetic head pulley above it so we can lift the steel off instead of trapping it.
Sure.
So we haven't tried it yet, but we know it'll work.
Yeah,
but that's what we're doing. The whole thing
is
trial and error.
Yeah, yeah.
But we're getting requests from people you wouldn't believe on the material that they want. Fine material. We have some requests. They want 70 mesh. That's over twice as fine as this finest one you saw.
Can you produce it?
We can.
Yeah.
But they'll use it in coatings and those kind of things.
Yeah.
Very expensive material.
Mm-hmm.
But we can make it.
Is that right?
We will probably be one of the only companies in the country on tire processing that can make the chips economically.
Hmm.
It gets kind of exciting.
It sure does.
We don't get it. We don't have the excitement from political forces, but we don't care at all.
As long as patience will eventually be rewarded. Eh?
Right. But it has been exciting, and you almost have to come to see a facility to
Well, I'm going to do that.
Oh, you have to. You have to do that.
Yeah, right? I'm really intrigued. I'm also intrigued as to the nature of the political resistance. I can understand environmental concerns if those were real, but from your description, that really is.
Well, we have to address all those kind of things, but it's just like we're stepping on into their backyard.
Yeah. And yet, everybody is uptight about how in the world we're going to dispose of this stuff.
Well, you kind of take Becker County. We're handling their waste right now. Their landfill is full.
Mm-hmm.
They have nowhere to go.
Yeah, yeah.
And there are other counties the same way. And most facilities have to have contracts, long-term contracts to make them work. We don't see that happening. Because we can compete with the landfill fees if they're above $20.
Yeah.
And Fargo's is going to be 24 January 1st.
Yeah.
You know, so that's no competition. So then somebody can decide, do they want to go to the landfill or do they want to go to our facility for that price?
Sure.
As long as we know where the waste is coming from, we can gear for it. But we don't feel we need the long-term contracts because what's their option?
Yeah. They're going to be generating it.
Yeah.
That you're
right.
Sure of.
They're going to have to get rid of it.
And they have to get rid of it.
Yeah. And I don't believe in incineration.
Yeah.
See, that was created back years ago in the 70s when there was an energy crisis.
Yeah.
And it didn't matter how much it cost to make the energy, just make it.
Yeah.
Now that isn't the problem.
Yeah.
Now the problem is how to get rid of the waste economically. Yeah. You can't do that in an incinerator.
No, because a substantial amount of waste is generated there. Yeah. Yeah. Well, it seems like we've covered the ground fairly well, but I guess anytime I do one of these interviews, I always say, "Well, you've got a last shot now. This is gonna be in the archive. Anything else that we should have covered?"
I really can't think of it. We covered a lot of areas, but it's we've had a lot of encouragement from the general public.
Mm-hmm.
When they can't believe the resistance we're getting and non-support, but. It's really exciting. That's the only thing I can say. It is exciting to take a waste and make it a good material again.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it sounds very exciting to me, too, and very interesting.
It is.
Thank you very much.
You bet, Bill.
Great.